I next met with Dr. Eileen O'Reilly to discuss the other issues covered in this satellite symposium, specifically pancreatic and gastroesophageal cancer. And to begin, she presented an older patient with metastatic pancreatic cancer in her practice.
This gentleman had come originally for a second opinion. He was a previously healthy 71-year-old man who had gotten relatively sick in a relatively short period of time with decreased appetite, weight loss, pain, and just progressive malaise, and had undergone a workup and identified to have a pancreas mass along with multiple liver metastases, some nodal and peritoneal disease. And biopsy was consistent with an adenocarcinoma, and he had a significantly elevated CA19-9. So our discussion was that of standard therapies initially, whether he would prefer or favor an approach of either FOLFIRINOX or gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, given a relatively high level of vigor but symptomatic. And I think in that context, either of those options would be reasonable choices in terms of disease control, palliation of symptoms, and hopefully extension of life versus participation in a clinical trial. And one of the, you know, the big clinical trial areas in pancreas cancer at the moment, and courtesy of nab-paclitaxel's approval, is adding novel drugs to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel as a backbone. And we had several, some phase 1b studies, so staggered depending on openings, and some randomized phase 2 trials using that cytotoxic backbone. And the one that we discussed and he ultimately elected to move forward with was a randomized double-blinded study adding a Notch 2-3 inhibitor to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel as frontline treatment for pancreas cancer.
And what was the background to the study? What was the agent?
The drug was OMP5905 or trastuzumab, which is a monoclonal antibody against Notch 2-3, which has been shown preclinically to have good activity against minimally passaged pancreas adenocarcinoma xenografts and also to have some putated stem cell toxin abilities. So it's, I think, an attractive concept. It has undergone phase 1b testing with safety and establishing dosing and establishing an early signal of efficacy, and is now completing a randomized phase 2 assessment, which will determine whether there's a sufficient signal to move forward to phase 3 testing.
So it's interesting, this man got this stem cell inhibitor, monoclonal antibody. Any comments about this new and exciting class of agents that's being looked at in GI cancers? I see a lot's going on with another agent that Philip talked about in the meeting, the oral cancer stem cell pathway inhibitor, BBI-608, and another one, BBI-503. How do these agents and the one your patient got, how do they work?
It has, again, putated broad activities in terms of stem cell effects, in terms of antivascular effects, and in terms of direct targeting of Notch receptors. And the underlying hypothesis is that there's a subset of patients that may benefit more from this approach compared to others. So the hypothesis is that people of high levels of Notch 2-3, which are prognostically poor predictors of outcome, may conversely benefit more from this approach. And that is being evaluated in the context of a gene assay to look at Notch expression pre-treatment and to correlate that with outcome. So that's a co-primary endpoint of the study looking at survival in the Notch 2-3 high patient population. I think the fundamental underlying principle, and this is, you know, a point of, I think, discussion, not necessarily consensus, is that one is trying to target this population of inherently treatment-resistant cells that are responsible for regrowth, for resistance to therapy, for development of escape mechanisms, and poorer outcomes, and that if this population of cells can be depleted and effectively treated, then maybe the cancer can be better controlled for longer. I think we have to validate this hypothesis, certainly with regard to this drug, but I think also if that's the exact group of cells that are being targeted, I think is still a question.
So this man then goes on the trial with NabGen plus this experimental agent. What happened?
Right, and I think one point to note that this is a randomized, double-blinded, placebo-controlled study, so we actually don't know whether or not he's been receiving the experimental agent. But either way, he's had, I would say, a very gratifying response, both clinically, supported radiologically, and supported by CA99 decline. And clinically, the things that were evident were that his pain started to lessen. He's not off pain medication, but noticeable improvement. His appetite improved. He's gained weight. His energy level has substantially improved, and he essentially has been working full time. I wouldn't say he never completely stopped, but he almost did for a period of time when the symptom burden was at his peak. So I think in terms of measures of success, there are some tangible ones there that we would say objectively from our side is very meaningful. And I think from the patient and his family's point of view, a lot of gratification too in terms of where things are. You know, the issues over time, and this is the luxury of success, is that the cumulative issues and side effects of treatment start to emerge. And he's had some of the nuisance side effects of edema, you know, perhaps some more anemia and fatigue in that context, and neuropathy. And he has had several dose adjustments of nab-paclitaxel. We haven't actually stopped it yet, but I sense that's looming shortly. And the other issues that emerged were an infection. He had an abscess that required incision and drainage, and he had a thrombosis, which may have been contributed both underlying disease and treatment.
Where was the abscess?
In the groin. It was probably a sebaceous cyst that got infected and required, as I say, a small incision and drainage procedure.
Now, I see that on presentation, this man had some weight loss, sweats, low-grade fever. C-reactive protein was 16. Is that elevated?
So that is elevated, or depending on what units you use, 10 was the cutoff internally, but that is elevated. And you might expect with that degree of symptom burden that for, you know, an inflammation-driven disease, it would be elevated.
And what happened on the treatment, particularly in terms of his weight?
So his weight got significantly better. I'm guessing now, but I think he probably put on at least 5 kilos in weight. More recently, he's gained a little bit of water weight, but real weight, about 5 kilos plus minus.
And what would you be thinking about his next therapy if he is to receive another line of therapy?
Right. So if and when progression arises, I think it will depend on, one, his level of well-being, and two, you know, what level of intensity of treatment would be comfortable. I think the quote-unquote standard choices, recognizing there's no defined second-line treatment in pancreas cancer, would be a fluoropyrimidine-based approach here. Data would support using FOLFOX or a version of it, or capecitabine and oxaliplatin. Or indeed, there's some data supporting FOLFIRINOX, and I think for this gentleman, that might indeed be a choice given his well-being. The other consideration would be a trial, and there's a lot happening now as there is in the frontline space and the second line space in pancreas cancer. And you sort of hinted at a potential consideration was because he has an elevated CRP, he may be a candidate for evaluation of a JAK inhibitor in a second line setting. And there are two registration phase 3 studies underway, the Janus 1 and Janus 2 trials, which have a very similar design. They're looking at capecitabine as a backbone plus ruxolitinib or placebo in a second-line setting for a subgroup of patients with gemcitabine refractory disease and an elevated CRP. So that would also be a possible consideration.
And actually, I guess you're the PI of the Janus 2 study?
Right. So both Janus 1 and Janus 2 are actively recruiting. So the background was based on data that was presented at ASCO in 2014, the RECAP trial that Herb Hurwitz presented, which was a approximately 120-130 patient randomized phase 2 in advanced pancreas cancer in patients who had received prior gemcitabine. And it's the exact question that's being tested in the phase 3. So it was using a capecitabine backbone and adding ruxolitinib or placebo to capecitabine. All comers were eligible, but there was a pre-specified hypothesis that patients with an elevated CRP or modified Glasgow prognostic score, which we'll come back to in a second, would be more likely to benefit. And indeed, that they were the results that were observed. The signal in the overall intent-to-treat population, irrespective of CRP, was that there was a trend, but not statistical significance in favor of the experimental arm. But in the elevated CRP group, there was statistical significance in terms of progression-free survival and in terms of overall survival, with a hazard ratio of under 0.5, which I think is interesting and not a big trial. And the nice thing about this study and this whole area is that it's sort of capitalizing on what we know are some of the challenges of pancreas cancer in terms of inflammatory disease, the cachexia, the upregulated interleukin, interferon pathways in this disease that, you know, haven't been well treated or well challenged, as it were, with other treatment approaches. Although I think the net effect of all our treatment is if the treatment works, it's affecting this, but this is specifically affecting those pathways in pancreas cancer. So there were some quality of life benefits observed in terms of weight gain and improved other outcomes. So both the Janus 1 and Janus 2 studies are now limited in terms of enrollment to patients with an elevated CRP. So it's a subset of the patients that were in the randomized phase 2, with a plan in total to recruit about 600 people, of which one study is over halfway accrued, the other is a little further behind. But I think, you know, 2017, maybe 16, late, we may have some data.
Of course, we've been talking about JAK inhibitors, specifically ruxolitinib and myelofibrosis, and now PVERA for a couple of years. From what I can tell or what I hear, the relatively well-tolerated quality life-wise, anemia is one issue that comes up. What about in pancreatic cancer?
I think that's the experience. There was no unexpected safety signal from the RECAP study, and so far our sense on the Janus studies is that remains true. Anemia is indeed an issue, and fatigue, some degree of myelosuppression, but relatively mild. And, you know, thrombotic events were observed, and was a question in the RECAP study whether that was therapy related. But I think when it was looked at it, it was more that patients on the experimental combination were on treatment longer. So prorated for time, the thrombotic events were similar in both arms of the study.
One of the things we talked about in the symposium was, and I think you showed a graph of the issue of weight, which is why I was asking about this man's weight. It seemed like the people who were treated with ruxolitinib did better from that point of view. Do you think that's for real? And do you think there's a phenotype? I mean, can you look at a patient and go, I think this patient's probably going to have a high CRP or maybe more, you know, cytokine type phenotype?
Yeah, so interesting question. And, you know, when I trained in Ireland, we did CRPs all the time. It was part of our routine testing. And I never drew a CRP in the US until the data from the RECAP study came out. So we're just getting a better feel for how these patients look and feel. But no, I honestly have been surprised. I sense all the time that it's going to be the sicker group of patients who are very symptomatic, have a large burden of disease, that are going to have an elevated CRP. And yes, that is true for many, but certainly for people I've seen with low volume disease, relatively asymptomatic, have an elevated CRP too. So I think we don't know fully yet how this looks across the spectrum of pancreas cancer. And we're certainly, again, going to accrue a lot of data on this because, as you said, it's getting at the fundamental quality of life issues is very attractive to patients, to us. And I think it's a major area in pancreas cancer that really hasn't been therapeutically targeted before.
So let's spend the rest of our time talking about gastroesophageal cancer. And Philip presented a couple cases that we discussed at the meeting. The first, a 60-year-old lady with HER2-negative gastric cancer presented with mets, the liver, and multiple nodes, who initially got treated with CAPOX, but after four cycles had disease progression. And we talked about, you know, how you think through second-line therapy in this situation. We asked the audience, and the vast majority did what Philip did, which is actually give her paclitaxel ramucirumab. But how do you think through this decision?
So for second-line therapy for gastric cancer, a big factor would be performance status for the patient and, again, the goals of care. And I think for a fitter individual, using a combination approach would be very rational. And data from both the REGARD and the RAINBOW trial will support the utility of ramucirumab in a second-line setting, either on its own or in combination with paclitaxel. And I think for a fitter individual, it would definitely favor using paclitaxel as the backbone, given higher survival benefit, not higher response benefit, but higher survival benefit and progression-free survival. And I think the data are convincing and support the utility of VEGF and here particularly receptor 2 targeting in gastric cancer. And, you know, going back to the days of the Avagast study, we sort of got a hint that this was therapeutically of potential value with the evaluation of bevacizumab on top of capecitabine or fluoropyrimidine and platinum-based therapy. But that trial, as you'll recall, didn't meet statistical significance. But I think in many people's opinion, for some groups of patients, it did. So I think this is the validation that VEGF targeting in gastric cancer is real and there's a benefit.
So this lady actually responded to the therapy, tolerated very well. What's your experience been with tolerability of ramucirumab, kind of like Bev?
I think it's well tolerated. Some fatigue and hypertension have been the main things. I've not seen any untoward side effects with ramucirumab, and certainly the feedback from patients is that it's a pretty palatable medication. More of the side effects, you know, tend to be from the taxane.
What's the thinking moving forward in terms of other uses of ramucirumab in gastric cancer? Is the thought to move it up into first line?
So indeed, being looked at in frontline therapy of gastric cancer, and I think that's a logical strategy. And again, the Avagast study sort of suggested that that was a potentially valuable approach. So ongoing randomized trial with ramucirumab, and we'll see where that fits. But yes, and I think the subsequent questions will be, like in colon cancer, if a niche is established in first line, is there a value to continuing it beyond disease progression in a second and subsequent line of therapy? I mean, we're far away from that yet in terms of data in gastric cancer, but I suspect that this will be the way the field may evolve in the coming years.
We're going to talk in a second about HER2-positive gastric cancer, and Philip had a case there, but I know we didn't have the HER2 data, although I think they presented some of that at ASCO from the ramucirumab trials. Do you incorporate it into the therapy of patients with HER2-positive gastric cancer?
So I think it's a decision of what to do in a second-line setting for a HER2-positive patient who's been treated with trastuzumab, and whether going with a ramucirumab-based approach or whether continuing HER2 targeting in the second-line strategy would be of greater benefit. And there's no data to support, I think, either approach yet in gastric cancer, which is discordant as yet with the analogies from breast cancer. But I think I've seen people do it both ways in terms of continuing trastuzumab in a second-line setting versus a switch. And I would say it would probably depend on the clinical situation of the patient. I think if the disease progression was evolving somewhat slowly, but clear that that was the disease trajectory, then maybe there is a value to continuing that strategy, but switching the cytotoxic backbone. If the disease trajectory is on the downhill course and symptoms emerging, then in my opinion, switching altogether in terms of a different treatment would have greater, I think, potential value for that individual.
Although, you know, the idea of combining anti-HER therapy or trastuzumab
with
chemotherapy
with
ramucirumab, you certainly think it might be well tolerated at least.
Yes, I think so. No data to support that. And I think in terms of, how shall I put it, but our raised red flags until we have data in terms of cost and in terms of approval. But yes, indeed, it's, I think, a very reasonable question to be asked and answered.
You know, there's also data looking at ramucirumab without chemotherapy as monotherapy. That was actually the first data set that came out. Are there any situations, you know, older patient, for example, or somebody with neuropathy, whatever, where you would use monotherapy? And would you combine it with anything other than a taxane?
Yeah, so I think it's a very reasonable consideration for an older person to think about single agent ramucirumab as opposed to using with chemotherapy. Patient preference, tolerability, low performance status would be circumstances where there is some attraction. Although, you know, lower dose paclitaxel is reasonably tolerated too. And certainly my bias looking at the data is the strength of the benefit is greatest with the combination, and probably would encourage it over single agent therapy most of the time. But I think there's clearly data to support single agent approach from the phase 3.
In terms of new approaches to gastroesophageal cancer, and this patient, like all patients with metastatic disease, is likely to be thinking about that pretty soon. A couple of things came out at ASCO I was curious about. One is I saw some data on regorafenib And, you know, I was kind of surprised. I guess it was different GI cancers, but including gastric. What were your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so regorafenib was looked at in an Australian and Asian study in a second-line setting and beyond in esophagogastric malignancies, a randomized phase 2 trial, which suggested that there was a progression-free survival benefit to the combination and at acceptable toxicity, and the investigators suggested that they thought it was worthy of a further evaluation. I'm not so sure. I think, yes, it looked like there was significance in terms of the endpoints. However, the magnitude of that benefit looked fairly modest. And regorafenib, as we know from our colorectal cancer experience, even though it's oral and it's attractive in that regard, isn't always the easiest of drugs for patients from the fatigue and rash point of view. So I don't know, but I think that that may go forward in terms of phase 3 testing. The other area where regorafenib is being looked at in esophagogastric cancers, a small randomized phase 2 in a resected high-risk adjuvant setting. So following induction chemoradiation, following surgery, those with node-positive, margin-positive disease getting randomized to regorafenib or observation. So that may also add to the data to develop regorafenib. But you mentioned, I think, interesting areas. I would say the highlight in gastric cancer was the KEYNOTE study that was data presented at GI ASCO earlier this year and then updated at the main meeting, looking at pembrolizumab in previously treated gastric cancer. And this was a small single-arm non-randomized study as part of the whole KEYNOTE series of trials, which looked at single-agent pembrolizumab given on a Q2-week schedule and saw in the PD-L1 positive patients that there was, I think, a significant signal in terms of response rate, and not just that, but also durability of response. They showed a very nice spider plot, and it's impressive when you see responses out to a year in a second and beyond setting of gastric cancer. You know, a lot of discussion, as in every other area where immune therapy and PD-1 and PD-L1 treatments have a role, is what the threshold for PD-L1 is, how that should be tested, and who should or should not be included. At least in that study, they looked at a threshold of 1% of tumor or stromal cells being positive, and that was one of the eligibility criteria for inclusion in the trial. So I think it's very interesting, and people are absolutely asking about this. So right now, we're not doing it outside of a trial. I do think we need more data and really to know, again, where the inclusion and exclusion criteria should be. I mean, certainly there's one argument that it's all comers and that there are people who clearly are PD-L1 negative by how we measure it that do respond. We know that from lung and other malignancies. And I think, you know, the ongoing trials in gastric cancer are looking further in second-line, third-line setting, looking combining with systemic therapy. And of course, I think if the signal holds, moving it into frontline therapy. So that's going to be, I think, a very exciting area over the next year to 18 months as these trials develop. Some are already started, additional KEYNOTE studies. And in Japan, there's a randomized study looking at pembrolizumab versus placebo in a second-line setting. So, yeah, a lot happening in this area. I suppose if a person wasn't trial eligible and there was a way to access it, I think it's fair. You have to discuss it. And this is what people are excited about. But I haven't actually done that yet. It was amusing at the meeting to hear Peter Enzinger say that his patients were asking him what was the most expedient way to get to a third line setting. I think that speaks to it, right?
Right. Yeah, that is interesting in order to become eligible for these trials.
Yeah.
So last thing I want to ask you about is HER2 positive gastroesophageal cancer. We talked a little bit about that, but I want to ask you something that we specifically actually asked the audience too, which is the question, and I'm not sure how often it occurs, but we actually had a case like this. It was presented at one of our meetings of a patient with locally advanced disease who was going to get neoadjuvant chemoradiation therapy and was found to be HER2 positive. And we asked the audience, you know, would you include trastuzumab in the chemoradiation? And a third said yes, and two-thirds said no. Most investigators, well, I don't know, I think they're kind of split. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly compelling in terms of the concept, but I think, again, we need data. And the RTOG study in locally advanced gastric cancer will hopefully answer this question. So looking at the addition of trastuzumab or not for people with localized esophageal gastric malignancies receiving systemic therapy and chemoradiation, but clearly need data outside of a trial setting. I think one would consider it, but you know, given that the toxicity of trastuzumab is pretty tolerable and given the signal in metastatic disease, it's hard not at least to discuss that. And I probably would recommend it in that setting outside of a trial setting. But preferably, we need to answer the question.
So every oncologist is asking about, you know, the new, they're in breast cancer, they're using T-DM1 all the time. They're using pertuzumab, and it just seems so intuitive to use it in gastroesophageal cancer. What do we know about those strategies at this point?
So all being evaluated in ongoing studies with T-DM1 and pertuzumab, and we will have data fairly soon. I think we've heard anecdotal experiences that there does appear to be a value, but remember, all of the HER2-targeting approaches in gastric cancer have not been successful. If we think about the lapatinib story, that didn't, for the most part, add, although maybe there is still a signal. So again, hopefully in the next year or so, we'll have data with regard to these second-generation HER2-targeted approaches and whether they will become integrated, as I think we all think they will, but we need data.